Accession number 30018, reel 17.
So, finally, reel 17.
The issue of ship motion, of course, is fundamental to differences between doing a vertical landing on land or on a ship's flight deck. And one of the things that I think, if we think about it, we all appreciate, but we do have to think about it, is that when a ship is rolling, and by that, you know what I mean, as it goes along, it's rolling from side to side, we often, if we're trying to walk through the corridors of a ship or on the flight deck, we find ourselves staggering slightly if we haven't got something to hang on to. And this is because the ship doesn't roll about the axis, about an axis that is in the floor we're standing on. Let's go to the flight deck of an aircraft carrier. The flight deck might be 50, 60 feet above the water. The ship is rolling about an axis that's in the water. So the flight deck doesn't just tilt left, then tilt right, tilt left, tilt right. It tilts left and sways over to the left. It goes as far as it's going to go, and then it starts coming back towards level, but the deck is moving sideways under our feet until it goes right out the other side again. So in a Harrier, if you sit in a hover over the top of a ship that is doing that sort of motion, with a little bit of experience, you set about going downwards so that you'll hit the deck as the deck is level. Because that's nice for your wheels, isn't it? You know, just as you want your wings level and you want to land with the deck level. Well, unfortunately, when you get it just right like that, you won't have the tidiest looking arrival because the ship's got its maximum sideways speed on there, or the flight deck has got its maximum sideways speed. And as the airplane hits the deck, it will have to be accelerated sideways, and this will give it the appearance of a great lurch as the ship transfers its motion through the tires and the friction into the airplane, and the airplane gives a wobble on its undercarriage. So you often see, if a ship has some motion, pilots landing, and it looks as if it, right at the very last moment, he went, oh dear. But that's nothing to do with the pilot. It's just the reality of ship motion. There's another aspect of ship motion, and that is when you do the short takeoff. I mean, we mentioned the bow down thing and the ski jump, looking after that, but there is also this left-right issue. Again, we said the ship is rolling left, right, about some point down at sea level. That means that the white line that you are steering along is literally moving sideways for a while, and then it rushes off sideways the other way over the seabed. Do you follow? And so the inertia of your aircraft, that is the normal sort of forces that you're trying to overcome when you accelerate an airplane, all those inertia based forces, as far as they're concerned, you're trying to go in a straight line over the seabed. Well, the gear won't let you, because the straight line you're following is actually describing a sort of S motion over the seabed, and you actually have to weave over the seabed in order to stay on the white line. So whenever you do a short takeoff on a ship, the first time it has motion on, you find for some unknown reason you can't stay on the white line. You think, God, why can't I do? You know, I thought I knew how to keep this thing straight, and you know, I'm lurching all over the place. Well, a moment's thought in the bath explains why you're having this problem, because you are used to going in a straight line and you haven't got to go in a straight line, you've got to go in a zigzag. Well, that's very difficult to do, and it seemed to me that the answer to this was to have a pair of parallel lines, and we call them tram lines. And these two lines, rather than the single centre line, define the safe area for you to wander about in. So relax, son, set off down the deck. Do not over control, do not try and be tremendously precise directionally, just relax and do nothing, providing you stay between these two lines. End of broadcast. And it's a delight. The Navy didn't like having to put tram lines on because I said, and by the way, you've got to do this at night. Oh, dear. I said, yes. And so they had to put twice the number of deck lights in to illuminate the line. And I can remember going to the MOD a few weeks before they launched Invincible, saying, I'm sorry, chaps, you've got to put another row of lights in. Oh, you know, it's a major mob. We should get taken to the cleaners by a Vickers who will say, you've got to take out these lights and put it up. You know, we can't. I said, well, in that case, you know, forget having Harriers. So, you know, you have these funny little sort of knock-on effects when you are trying to get a new system into service.
How did the development programme pan out once you got the go-ahead? What was the kind of... how did you structure it then?
Well, the structure of the Sea Harrier flight development programme was totally standard. There was a specification which had been agreed on paper between the two parties and or between us, the company and MOD procurement executive. And in order to show that your aircraft meets the specification, because the specification isn't necessarily going to be just how long it is and how much it can carry, but it must be maybe some other performance aspects and so on, and serviceability. So you will, out of the specification, you will come up with a list of sort of milestones which are contract definition points, what were called in the trade spec points. We had to go and demonstrate that we met the spec, and some of those demonstrations could only be done in flight. And but it was all quite straightforward. There were no technical issues, and we knew our aeroplane inside out. We knew because we had worked on the spec. We had suggested what it should be like, for goodness sake, you know, because we knew what we could do. But I mentioned that the rest of the world, you know, didn't really believe us at all. And it wasn't until the Falklands happened, when 21 Sea Harriers went down all that way. They were serviceable all the time. They didn't have to keep having engine changes. None of the dire things that were forecast and perceived as being the result of it being just an airshow aeroplane, you know. The only people who used to deride a Harrier were those people who had no personal experience of it. Now, they may have had their own reasons, vested interests. If they make ordinary conventional aircraft, they're going to suggest the Harrier's rubbish, aren't they? You know, there was a lot of that. But after the Falklands War, the whole thing just changed totally.
Was there an element, I think you'd mentioned it before, of some of the people who derided the Harrier, or the Sea Harrier, was it their lack of understanding of the aircraft as well? I think you mentioned before sometimes some of the aviation press had got the wrong end of the stick. Was that still continuing on to the sort of Sea Harrier phase?
Oh, I think so, yes. And you won't stamp it out. I mean, what was I looking at the other day? It was a chap on the television who was extolling the virtues of the new Joint Strike Fighter and so on. And he still felt that when you operated vertically, you had this huge fuel penalty. And, I mean, it is so obviously wrong to anybody who thinks. The first time the Royal Air Force produced 8 or 10 aeroplanes at a Farnborough airshow was, I think it was 1971 or two, and one squadron came along and they had all their aeroplanes airborne together. They came to the hover, spaced all along the main runway, you see, and they're sitting there doing a combined bow and this sort of drill manoeuvres, and there was a United States Air Force general with his entourage standing in the Hawker City Chalet, you see, and he was banging on, because the United States Air Force has never been a fan of Eastall. He was banging on about what a waste of fuel and all the rest of it this was, and I stood up close behind him and said, no, it's not like that, sir, they've got jet engines, you see. And nothing happened the first time I said it, so I repeated it, and you could see the aides on either side horrified that this bloke, who they had no idea who I was, you know, in hospitality, shall I, saying to their general that these things have got jet engines, you know. I said, you know, sir, jet engines, the air comes in the front, you burn fuel in it, and it rushes out the back and it gives you thrust. That's a jet engine. Now, unfortunately, the amount of fuel you can burn in such a jet engine depends on how much air you can get through it. Those chaps can't get much air through. They're having to suck it through. And so their fuel consumption is not that high. When they are flying along fast, the air's rammed into their intakes and you can burn a lot more fuel. And, well, I mean, it's just the fact of life that some people who you would think would be properly educated are not. They have these preconceived ideas. Don't tell me about that, my mind's made up type stuff. Yes, there are other misconceptions. And that still exists today. So,
and as you were developing the Sea Harrier, what were the main sort of trial areas that you were working on? Can you explain to me? I know obviously you said how the specification works, but what were the areas that you were looking at?
Well, we had a new range of stores that the aircraft had to carry. They were different from the ones at the Royal Air Force. We had this thing called Sea Eagle, which is a big anti-shipping missile. During the actual stage just before we got the contract to do the Sea Harrier, we had to demonstrate one or two things which the Navy would need in their spec and demonstrate them to the satisfaction of the MOD without the Sea Harrier happening. So we took a Royal Air Force Harrier development aeroplane and we did things with it which suggested quite clearly that we would be able to meet our targets on the Sea Harrier. For example, I fired a Martell. Now, a Martell was a very large air-to-surface missile, weighed about 1,800 pounds, and it was a TV-guided thing in those days. It was used from Buccaneers. I fired a Martell from an RAF Harrier to show that it would have no trouble dealing with a Sea Eagle, which hadn't yet happened, which was only going to be 1,500 pounds in weight and would actually do a lot of things that the Martell would not do, you know, in the normal course of improvement. So, yes, we fired a Martell. I actually came to the hover with a Martell on one side and not on the other because people were saying, if you take off with two Sea Eagles and you only fire at one target, the thing's too expensive, you must better bring it back. So we demonstrated that with only a 200-pound weight balancing store on the other outboard pylon, we could bring back a single Sea Eagle. So the idea was that when you took off with Sea Eagles, you would have a lead weight of 200 pounds on each of your outboard pylons, and in the event that you only got rid of one Sea Eagle, then you jettisoned the other lead weight and you came back and landed vertically. That was the notion behind it all. So yes, there were things like that that we did. We had to demonstrate that the aircraft would stall properly and manoeuvre properly with this new raised cockpit, which had, I mean, the whole nose in front of the intakes was a different shape, and so lots of the engine work had to be cleared. But nothing revolutionary, just ordinary standard flight development test work.
Am I right in thinking that you had some development work on the heads-up display for the pilots as well?
Yes, the avionics, of which the head-up display was just one aspect, was continually changing in both the Royal Air Force and the Sea Harrier programme, because the avionics manufacturers were coming up with better kit, and so the head-up display had more and more symbols and things put on it for the Royal Air Force when it came to the laser being fitted and so on. And exactly the same thing with the Royal Navy. We had better optics in the Royal Navy because for the head-up display, because people had produced better optics 15 years later than when the first Royal Air Force HUDs were done. But this is all routine, gradual, progressive improvement. So the head-up display was better. And better can be defined as clearer, brighter, shows up against, the images show up against a bright light better. And also something called the field of view, which is how accurately you have to position your head in the cockpit to see all the information. With the original head-up displays, you had to put your head in a pretty specific position if you were to see it all. A bit like using binoculars, you know. As the optics got improved, there was more flexibility in where your head could be when you glanced at the head-up display. These days, of course, they have not got rid of the head-up display, but it is no longer on the aeroplane, it is on the helmet. So with a Typhoon, they're going to have helmet-mounting displays. With the Joint Strike Fighter, it's a helmet-mounted display. This means, of course, that you carry the display with you wherever you turn your head. So, but this is all just progressive and gradual stuff, and has not got anything to do really with how you make the flying machine work better.
And with the radar that had been introduced, were there any trials on the radar, or was that something that was?
No, there were some very interesting trials to be done with the radar, and we used a two-seat Hunter for that purpose. We fitted the Sea Harrier radar into the nose of a specially modified two-seat Hunter, and we could then take a radar boffin along in the other seat and show him what was right or wrong with his radar. I'm struggling with the dates again, but I would think it would be somewhere around the 1977-70, probably 78 time, when as part of the build-up of the actual Sea Harrier development program, we got clearance to modify two Hunters. One of them was going to the Royal Navy for training, and the other was staying at Dunsfold for development work of the radar. I was only too conscious that, because I was chief test pilot by then, that the other pilots in my team were all ex-Royal Air Force pilots. And whilst we'd all been fighter pilots in some era or other, and while we'd all been instructor pilots, which was also important to understand some of the issues of training service pilots and so on, none of us had been fleet airarm pilots. Now, this bothered me because I had no idea what a fleet airarm pilot did after he took off from his ship. I was sufficiently arrogant that I didn't need any help from Royal Navy pilots to tell me how to take off and land on their ship, because that was a Harrier peculiar thing, and I'd done it from 12 or 14 ships anyhow by then. But I was very conscious that the way they tactically organised, navigated, controlled and everything else, their airplanes from ships, we knew nothing about, because the whole moving base thing, I mean, you could be away for an hour and your base has moved 30 miles. And there are the tactics associated with submarines and other surface fleets and, you know, the whole thing. So I wanted some advice on this, because I wanted to make sure that what we were putting into the cockpit of this Sea Harrier was optimised for somebody that needed to do that sort of job with his airplane, not just the takeoff and landing bit. And so I went to some friends in the Royal Navy and said, look, I want one of your best youngsters off Ark Royal, which was just decommissioning. I want one of your best young fighter pilots to come and be a Royal Navy liaison officer at Dunsfold. Well, what's he going to do? Well, he's going to sit around in the crew room with us, and he's going to talk about tactics. He's going to go to meetings with us where we discuss what's going in the aeroplane and so on. He's going to be responsible for educating us, the Dunsfold pilots, about what we don't know about naval operations. Fine. I said, by the way, it would help if he could read and write properly, because I mean... a lot of very good service pilots do it intuitively. They couldn't describe what is important. They couldn't argue the case in a meeting. They are brilliant when it comes to actually executing it, but then they just get drunk and don't know what, you know, till they go and brilliantly do it again. I said, I want somebody who can talk and actually explain things. And so they sent me somebody called Taylor Scott. And he was personable enough, young gentleman, and a lieutenant commander, and so within a day or two of coming to Dunsfold, I said, right, Taylor, we're going off in the Hunter. And he was going to have his first look at the Sea Harrier cockpit, roughly as we had lashed it up in the right-hand side of this Hunter, and the radar and all this. Well, I don't know. 20 minutes into that sortie, I realised that it wasn't just a case of Taylor helping us. Taylor ought to be running that Hunter two-seat development program. He ought to be put in charge of it, because his comments and his perceptiveness about the whole thing was way beyond the capabilities that we had. And of course the Navy were very happy, and Taylor did a brilliant job. He spent all of his time talking to our radar engineers and our head-up display engineers and our cockpit designers about these fleet air arm aspects. And he could make good arguments, he could write good reports, he could study the minutes of meetings and say that's wrong, you know, got to check. He was brilliant, and he was absolutely super. And if there was one person that deserves a medal for the way the Sea Harrier was operated in the Falklands, I don't mean just the way it flew, I mean the way it was operated, it's Taylor, because he made sure that what was in that cockpit was what the naval pilots needed to do their job. He was fairly sort of outgoing chap, like a lot of service pilots are, and of course he didn't just want to fiddle about with the Hunter, he wanted to fly Harriers. And there was no way I could get him approval to, easily anyhow, to approval to fly Harriers. Because by then, and we're talking 78 or 9 time, you could no longer just jump into a Harrier and fly it. Because there was now a Harrier training system. And the sort of health and safety people, you know, would say, well, he's got to go and do the Harrier course. And somebody got to pay for that course, et cetera, et cetera. But Taylor used to come in on 4 or 5 times a year and kick the other side of my office desk and say, I'm off if you don't get me on Harrier course and all this sort of thing. And one day he came along absolutely on the last straw and he said, I'm off. I said, when you're off? He said, tomorrow. And I said, well, that's a pity, because you could start the course on Tuesday. And I just managed to fix him up with the course, you see. So, of course, he was over the moon. But poor lad, he was later killed in a Harrier, an RAF Harrier, with a bang seat malfunction, an eject seat malfunction, where he got tossed out of the airplane at high altitude. But there we are. That's just life. And these things happen. But Taylor Scott was absolutely instrumental in the operational efficiency of that aeroplane. When the Falklands War happened, of course, he wanted to go down there. And the Navy, and full marks to them, they wouldn't let him go. They said, you are coming to Yelverton and you are going to finish the training of the Harrier pilots that are halfway through. They realised, if you like, the sort of multiplying factor that Taylor could apply, and of course he hated being there, but he managed to produce during the short course of the war another 4 or 5 Harrier pilots, and that was Royal Navy Harrier pilots. That was very good.
Can you think of anything specifically that he was able to instill in the team? I'm trying to think of what knowledge he gave you, or what things specifically he could think of that you hadn't thought of or you needed.
Well, yes, his experience enabled him to sort out something called the Modin switching document. Now, when you look at the cockpit of a modern military aeroplane, it's full of switches and dials and knobs and buttons and goodness knows what. And you might say, well, what's all that about? Well, the answer is it's about controlling what is a complicated piece of equipment. Now, the various modes that you can set a cockpit up, I mean, you mentioned the head-up display, there were over 100 different pages of information that could be put up on the head-up display. And so you could optimise the information that was on head-up display for the particular task of a particular sortie. There was one, for example, for controlling a ski jump takeoff at night. There was another one for dealing with a sea eagle, and so on. And Taylor was able to prioritise, I hate that word, but we all use it now, prioritise these modes to establish which were the important ones, which were the ones that were easiest to select in the cockpit and not buried deep in the menu, you know? Which ones are going to be default, what's the, you know, all these sort of things. Where do we physically put three or four of these switches? Because they've got to be operated in that order. So that's what I mean when I say that Taylor was able to improve the operational efficiency, not the flying machine efficiency, but the ability to use that device to fight with. All down to him, that cockpit. I suggested that the Falklands War transformed the reputation of the Harrier and the Sea Harrier, because of course it did everything that we had expected it to, and the world by and large did not expect it to. I happened to be airborne the Friday that it all started in XZ-450, which was the first Sea Harrier prototype. I was flying with two Sea Eagles on the aeroplane, plus a couple of sidewinders, plus a couple of guns. A very heavy configuration. And I was looking at conventional stalling characteristics of the aeroplane with all that load on. And I landed, went into flight development to debrief the sortie with my roll of instrumentation tape and all the rest of it and stuff. And I'm halfway through this debrief when the door gets kicked in, and in comes Taylor Scott, about a foot and a half off the floor, saying that he was off, he's going back to the Navy, there was a war on, and he was off. And so I sort of smiled at him, and I said, sorry, Taylor, I said, what's happening? He said, oh, he said, we're going to get a war. And I said, all right, well, I don't think it'll all be settled in the next couple of hours, so let me just finish this debrief, and then you and I can go and talk about what's happening. So I went along to the tower afterwards, and he explained that the Argentinians had invaded and a task force was going to go down and they wanted all the Sea Harriers. I said, okay, well, right, this is a Friday afternoon, and normally on that day the place shut down about 4:30. So we made preparations for having the night shift enhanced, shall we say, to try and get as many aeroplanes prepared as we could. And I went home to have some tea, and while I was having some tea, the telephone went. And it was one of the policemen on the main gate saying that they're manning the tower and they're putting all the airfield lights on. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the Navy are coming in and they want all the lights on. So I said, you go and turn all the lights off and shut down air traffic. I said, because the Navy's not coming in here tonight. We are not ready for them. And, you know, this needs to be done in slightly slower time. I don't mind if the ships are steaming off. We'll soon catch those over the next couple of days. Leave us in peace. We want to... So the Navy did come and were sent away with a flea in their ear. They were arriving in various helicopters with a whole lot of Harrier pilots, and they were going to take away everything they could let... I mean, there was that sort of silliness going on at the time. Well, we worked long and hard that weekend, and in fact, Saturday morning, Taylor Scott took 450 and landed it on Hermes in the dock as they were preparing the ship. And so gradually, during the course of Friday night and Saturday and Sunday night, we prepared all the Sea Harriers that were in anything like deliverable condition. And the preparation meant not just putting them together, but taking out our test equipment and so on, which, you know, was only going to encumber them. Now, as it happened, I was booked on an airliner on the Sunday to go to the United States in order to carry on with some engine development trials at Edwards Air Force Base on the AV-8B Harrier for the Marine Corps. the big wing one.